Are you afraid of the dark? I think the people that study things like that say being afraid of the dark is related to our primal fears. Like when Homo sapiens and Neanderthals were kicking around in Europe. Not sure if this would go all the way back to our favorite Lucy in Ethiopia, bipedal primate, human ancestor, Australopithecus afarensis. I'm not sure that what we're talking about is the same dread as a lion hunting you versus, say, a zombie maybe. The horror that the grays might get you, but you'll be back with messed up memories, like migratory moths passing by. Or a totally well-known, lurking in the dark kind of monster, like a pale crawler, shadow people, or something more esoteric. Like a phobia. As it relates to this episode, the German word Mörder is the root of Mottphobia, the fear of moths. How do you feel about moths? Our fluttery neighbors, night pollinators doing their nocturnal thing. They start out as an egg the size of a grain of sand, 0.5 to 1.5 millimeters, if you're reaching for your ruler. Then hatch pretty close to their food source that the caterpillars will need. That might include the folds of a nice and cozy sweater in which to begin their caterpillar era. From there, the Houdini metamorphosis of pupa inside their cocoon leads to a moth, with upper and under wings drying before they fly. A portion of near-death experiencers head toward a mysterious, seemingly comforting light, like moths making a beeline for a glowing lampshade. Some report family waiting there to greet them. I've wondered about that. If you had a negative family experience, can you dodge and weave? Anyway, some, or is it all moths, are drawn to light, and it seems like some people may be too. During that near-death moment, this is a small commonality between beings on our blue planet. Bit of a stretch, maybe, but there we have it. There was a scholar known as Joseph Campbell. If you haven't heard of him, let me take just a quick minute to introduce him. Joseph studied the human condition through comparative mythology. Which is actually kind of a big deal in my opinion. We'll come back to this. He also studied world religions, and he clears away the cobwebs of old beliefs and better than otherness crapology, sweeping white privilege to the garbage, revealing our interconnectedness as human beings. Kind of like a flat organization where nobody is better than anybody else. Different jobs, of course. But you're all there together. We're all here together. In the 1980s, he discussed storytelling and the hero's journey, showing a common pattern in mythology all over the world, an archetypal hero story that had emerged independently across cultures. When talking with Bill Moyers, Campbell explained the monomyth, the hero's journey, a step-by-step story pattern. Campbell changed my life. I was raised in a religious household where our faith was seen as the one truth. Note, my dad taped this lecture series for me. Hearing that all humans had this connection, that myths and storytelling across the globe revealed a shared humanity, reached beyond judgment and division. It opened my eyes to a different reality of equality. Thanks, Dad. Our differences don't divide us. Our myths and stories reveal our shared experience. Maybe that's why I quote Joseph Campbell in this episode, because his insights are timeless. Via Wikipedia on the monomyth, quote, "A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man." This was by Campbell, Joseph, 1949. The Hero with a Thousand Faces, First Edition, Princeton, New Jersey, Princeton University Press, Second Edition, 1968. Does this sound familiar? George Lucas was a fan. Think about the Star Wars space opera. That sounds a little overkill, but the pattern is there. Luke, the hero, receives his call from a herald. His family's death forces a choice. Ben and the Force. Transformation. He leaves Tatooine. And his mentor, helper, Yoda, starts teaching him to be a Jedi. A slippery slope. He heads into the abyss of darkness. First through his vision in the cave on Dagobah. Then the adventure on the Death Star. Into the evil lair of Darth Vader. Death, Ben dies, and none of them can save him. Death and rebirth, no! Then atonement. He saves the princess, they escape, and they return to the rebellion with the boon, the gift of the goddess, to share. They will live to fight another day. Luke has been transformed from a teenage moisture farmer on Tatooine to a starfighter pilot and hero. Phew! And to quote Yul Brynner in The King and I, etc., etc., etc. Just without the accent, it's not the same. But we seek commonality, understanding, stories of adventure, and we seek the light of understanding with the Mothman, Metamorphosis, Steel and Paint, in which the WGP story of two artists, Roach and Frazetta, float amongst dust motes, flicker floating under streetlights, with the moths and their feathery antenna. I've been finding my way to the end of this story over the last few months. I've scraped the interwebs for Mothman deets. YouTube satisfied my armchair tourism urge for urban exploring in a West Virginian ghost town, with Thurmond, West Virginia, a ghost town gone bad, on YouTube by part-time explorer. And with months of notes, well, I needed to get organized. By the way, if you hear a snoring dachshund in the background, Lily, one of our alumni at rmdr.org, is sitting right next to me sleeping. She is recovering from a surgery, and so she's taking many naps. But as a dachshund, they tend to take a fair amount of naps anyway. While Mothman stories abound on the web and on podcasts, stories of a dog gone missing, the TNT area that sounds haunted, maybe by Mothman, Mothman gliding above a car at up to 100 miles an hour, well, the strangeness surrounding this time period, stories of men in black and aliens, and the wildness of the Appalachian Mountains and forests, hills and hollers gives us a setting with long shadows to explore for the unknown. Whispering Gallery Podcast, Mothman, Metamorphosis, Steel and Paint, Part 2. A chocolate for Mothman? Do you ever find yourself hesitating over a box of chocolates? Like it's a weighty decision. A friend offers, "Have a chocolate." And suddenly it feels like they handed you a, well, sticky situation. Are there even any caramels? Or any of what you'd consider good chocolates left? You crack open the box like Pandora, peeking inside to see what's left. Hope. Ha ha ha. Yeah. You were hoping for a delicious chocolate or a chocolate guide. If you're like me, you've probably tossed that little cheat sheet once or twice thinking it was just marketing fluff. Nope, turns out it's your only defense against an orange cream decoy or a cherry cordial ambush. Continuing carefully, removing the bubble wrap from the lid, keeping things sanitary, being very mindful, very demure. Inside, it's a landscape of mystery. Glossy domes, bumpy clusters, chocolate swirls frozen mid-drip. Is that rectangle caramel, almond nougat, or a buttercream, disguised as a piece of fudge? You only get one shot, choose poorly, and you're stuck with something unidentifiable that may taste like chocolate and cough syrup. And what's with the cryptic chocolate swirl code? Are chocolatiers secretly training us to decipher encrypted messages? A few pro tips from Epicurious. Round shapes mean soft centers. Squares are usually caramels. Unless they're not, they might be fudge. And yellow might indicate lemon. Spoiler alert, the square theory didn't work on a box of C's. So why all this talk about chocolates? Because we're choosing spooky art stories, and that isn't so different. Some are sweet and irresistible. Others are, well, an acquired taste. Like artisanal chocolates, they come in all shapes and flavors. Take Mothman, for example, a cryptid as legendary as the chocolate truffle at the center of the box, nestled in its own fancy paper. A little larger than life, equal parts spooky and fascinating, the statue in Point Pleasant, a tourist magnet. Frazetta's painting? Iconic. Mothman is artisanal chocolate of the cryptid world. Dark, mysterious, and oddly compelling. But here's the real question. If the early bird gets the worm, and the night owl gets the chocolate, what does Mothman get? Welcome to the Whispering Gallery podcast. I'm Suzanne Nicolaiasen. Shotzi's here, our foster Penny is right next to me, and Boomer is up on the back of the couch behind me. My usual spot for recording is being remodeled, so here we are in the living room. You can probably hear the chimes outside the front door. But if I waited any longer to try and find the perfect time to record, I don't know how long we'd all be waiting, so here we are. I think Mothman might reach for a heavenly smooth, double chocolate hazelnut mocha frappe for his midnight power-up with light, fluffy whipped cream contrails boosting him up past the telephone poles, beyond the treetops, to give him silent, zeppelin-like gliding through the dead of night to the moonbeam-painted wisps of clouds. Thank you for joining me for this story. You have an eye for detail and depth, seeing things others might miss. That's a rare and beautiful gift. Each of these stories adds a little more detail, and it's time for the rest of Mothman's story, where artists meet folk hero, cryptid, first spotted in coal mining country along the Rust Belt. His sightings and spirit immortalized in a steel statue in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where his sightings first occurred. A couple of things about the countryside where he was sighted. I've got a quote from Time and Custom Stands Still in the Hills and Hollers of West Virginia by Charles Hillinger on February 10, 1985 in the Los Angeles Times. Quote, West Virginia is America's mountain state. The entire state is Appalachian Mountains. Wave after wave of mountains, like a sea. Most of the state's nearly 2 million people live in narrow mountain valleys called hollers. Unquote. I was wondering, is Point Pleasant settled in a holler? ChatGPT explained, Point Pleasant, West Virginia isn't really in a holler, in the traditional Appalachian sense. It's located at the confluence of the Ohio and Kanawha rivers, which makes it more of a river town than a tucked-away valley settlement. However, the surrounding areas do have the kind of hills and hollers typical of West Virginia. The Mothman metamorphosis story is one that only gets stranger the deeper we go. There are many things that make up the story holistically. For example, did you know the land was cursed? Let's talk about the curse of Chief Cornstalk in West Virginia, shall we? Before he died, Cornstalk uttered what has become known as the curse of Cornstalk. And this is the curse of Chief Cornstalk, posted by the historic Daniel Boone Home on Facebook. Quote, I was the border man's friend. Many times I have saved him and his people from harm. I never warred with you, but only to protect our wigwams and lands. I refused to join your pale-face enemies with the redcoats. I came to the fort as your friend, and you murdered me. You have murdered by my side my young son. For this may the curse of the Great Spirit rest upon this land. May it be blighted by nature. May it even be blighted by its hopes. May the strength of its peoples be paralyzed by the stain of our blood. Unquote. Chief Cornstalk, November 10th, 1777. Then I worked on reading The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel. The 1960s book that's often called the cornerstone of Mothman lore, kind of the Holy Grail. I had to make myself finish reading it. While it's full of all kinds of different experiences, not just Mothman sightings, witness stories to other strange events, it's also a time capsule of its era, complete with casual and irritating sexism and bizarre, unverifiable tangents that had little to do with Mothman. Unsurprisingly, the book inspired parts of the Men in Black movie. Mothman Metamorphosis, Steel and Paint involves mystery and tragedy that's captivated people for decades. So here we are in part two of our journey. Let's unravel the layers, separate the myth from the facts, and see what new insights we can uncover about the strange and enduring legend of the Mothman and two of the iconic pieces of art it inspired. Strange, shadowy stories are shared and whispered after the lights go out at the Whispering Gallery. Podcasts playing softly in the dark, or whispering voices mingling with the crackle of twilight campfires, blowing a kiss to the stars. Eerie sightings and the tragedy that followed touch our lives, and together we flee like moths on night breezes. Buoyant in streetlight, we sail on shadows to seek out our favorite cryptid, the Mothman. Almost Heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. These haunting lyrics come from Take Me Home, Country Roads, spun into Audio Sunshine by John Denver and released in 1971. When you read older than the trees, there's a certain spine-tingling sense, like an ancient something or someone could have been around then, measuring time, years, seasons, and yes, we could count the tree rings. Did you know that out of the 16 million acres of original West Virginia forest, there are only 263 acres remaining due to logging and fire? Are the souls of so many ancient trees killed and taken from their forests, lingering in the ancient mountains and dells? Have you heard about the mycorrhizal network? There might be more to this forest awareness than we might think. From an AI overview courtesy of Google Search, quote, the network among tree roots is called a mycorrhizal, hope I'm saying that right, network. It's a system of fungi that intertwine with tree roots, connecting them underground and allowing for the exchange of nutrients and water between different trees. Unquote. Depends on what website you're reading. Sprouting Forest History. Trees from regrowth are actually pretty new for trees. They're about 100 years old. Via Bob's Market and Greenhouse and West Virginia Forestry, WVForestry.com, reads, quote, "By 1900, it's estimated there were hundreds of large mills in West Virginia, harvesting red spruce, hemlock, and other valuable hardwoods. Timbering operations peaked around 1910, and by its relative decline in the mid-1920s, forests were eventually timbered out. As a result, large amounts of slash were left behind from operations that weren't managed well. This created fodder for wildfires that burned thousands of acres. Trees left behind died of exposure, and soil erosion caused major floods. The need for regulation was evident," unquote. By the mid-1900s, where's a Mothman to live? But some people theorize that he came from another world, maybe a lost pet of visiting aliens. Younger than the mountains. A lot of things are younger than the mountains. J.R.R. Tolkien's book, The Hobbit, gives us the poem, "Far over the misty mountains cold," in the chapter, "An Unexpected Party," about one of Middle-earth's memorable landmarks under which labyrinthine tunnels wandered through the darkness. What do you think? Would the pitch dark under a mountain in the maze-like tunnels be the same black as a West Virginia coal mine? How about as black as Venta Black, which absorbs 99.8? Shotzi's now climbing up onto the back of the couch to watch out the curtain. Would it be as black as Venta Black, which absorbs 99.8% of light? Or MIT's blackest black? Oh hey, let's geek out about color for a moment, shall we? From MIT News about the blackest black, Black 4.0, it absorbs 99.95% of light. Quote, "The material is made from vertically aligned carbon nanotubes, or CNTs, microscopic filaments of carbon, like a fuzzy forest of tiny trees, that the new team grew on a surface of chlorine-etched aluminum foil. The foil captures at least 99.995% of any incoming light, making it the blackest material on record." This was in 2019 from MIT News, news.mit.edu. "Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep and caverns old, we must away ere break of day to seek our pale enchanted gold." I have a quote hanging on the wall in my family room. I'm sorry, but it isn't live, laugh, love. Instead, it comes from the book The Hobbit, about Bilbo's home, a hobbit hole. And Bilbo's home was Huga before we'd ever heard of it. From The Hobbit, it reads, quote, "A perfect house, whether you like food or sleep, or storytelling, or singing, or just sitting and thinking best, or a pleasant mixture of them all," unquote. We've all got our landing places, as comfy, Huga, to our aesthetic and vibe as we can make them. Friendly stomping grounds, great big trees we love, soft blankets on the couch. Well, often the dogs claim them first. Places familiar with memories, safe from dragons like Smaug, beyond the notice of the ringwraiths. Do we take our very precious feeling of being safe and sound for granted? Counting on it? No, depending on it, being there at the start of each new day? And how real is that being safe and sound for any of us? With the recent executive orders being fired off here in the United States, it has unsettled many of us. So let's get going to the self-titled Wild and Wonderful State of West Virginia, on the eastern side of the United States. Ancient mountains and forests? Check. What about Mothman? This is where he was spotted before the Chicago sighting. I'm not sure how many other sightings were just focusing on Point Pleasant. In this countryside or mountainous region, there are a lot of ghost towns and hollers. On Wikipedia, there are currently 3 scrolls worth of ghost towns in West Virginia. More specifically, 102 are listed. Why so many? There was a boom-to-bust coal industry that was the reason for some of it. One thing you might want to do is go on YouTube and look up West Virginia ghost towns. there are some urban explorers that will take you through. That's kind of spooky and interesting to see. In 2023, 3,908 people lived in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the epicenter of the Mothman sightings, which sits at approximately 39.976 degrees north and 80.4549 degrees west. Those are just numbers on a map, of course, but if you were able to go straight through to the other side of the globe, you'd find yourself in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Maybe it's a fitting contrast, perhaps one side cloaked in forests and folklore, the other in mysterious waters. West Virginia's state motto, Montani Semper Liberi, translates to Mountaineers are always free, which feels perfectly fitting for a place so rugged. It's a state of coal mines and salt deposits, blueberry thickets and forests, Appalachian traditions, cornbread, apple butter, and yes, even their famous pepperoni rolls. I remember in my hometown, the closest we came to pepperoni rolls was Little Caesar's pepperoni bread, but that had cheese too, which it seems could be an offensive comparison to some. Them's fighting words, you know? But it's what we had in the middle of the night in Utah when we ran to Video Vern's to rent a movie. People feel strongly about pepperoni rolls. We're just a side tangent, real quick. From a tried and true recipe.com, quote, a true pepperoni roll should consist of an almost sweet tasting bread of the softest and pillowy proportions. It should be more similar to a challah bread than anything else. But even then, that's not quite right. The rich butter soft texture is the perfect environment for all the warm, spicy pepperoni oil to leach into as it bakes, which helps diffuse the bread and the meat, a process which continues to occur over the next day, which is why day-old pepperoni rolls taste the best. And the egg wash is absolutely incorrect. What should be done after baking is to gently run a stick of butter over the top of the rolls fresh out of the oven. This gives it a rich flavor and helps keep the rolls soft throughout as they are meant to be. Unquote. And this sparked hurt feelings and debate. West Virginia is the only state entirely within the boundaries of Appalachia. It's in this region of the United States that the unsettling events surrounding the Mothman sightings began to unfold. Point Pleasant commemorates its infamous cryptid with a gleaming 12-foot-tall statue of the Mothman, sculpted by Bob Roach. The polished steel figure is both a tourist attraction and a haunting reminder of the mysteries that still linger in the dark. Roach's artistry has become part of the lore, his stainless steel Mothman catching the light like a phantom captured in time. And speaking of seeing someone in time, under the protection of fair use, this is a quote from John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies. Quote, the grin remained fixed on his face throughout the episode. Do not be afraid of me, he said several times in an audible voice. His name, he said, was Vadig. He spoke with Tom, the witness, for several minutes, asking ordinary questions about where he was from, where he was going, what he did, etc. Finally, he said pointedly, I'll see you in time. And walked back to the object, a small door opened and a metal ladder folded down. A hand reached out and helped Vadig aboard. Then the thing rose silently into the air and disappeared. Unquote. Let's take a short break and get back to our story. The Moth, the Myth, the Legend. The sighting of Mothman stirred things up and made a less-than-verifiable-sounding headline in the Point Pleasant Registry, the local newspaper. Couples see man-sized bird, creature, something. Via Mary Heyer, an experienced journalist with the Athens, Ohio Messenger, who covered the Mothman sighting and those that followed. The article, Winged Red-Eyed Thing Chases Point Pleasant Couples Across Countryside, was published on November 16, 1966. Let's take a minute to read the article that reported on the sighting that started the encounters, shall we? The Winged Red-Eyed Thing Chases Point Couples Across Countryside by Mary Heyer, Point Pleasant correspondent. Point Pleasant, what stands 6 feet tall, has wings, two big red eyes 6 inches apart, and glides along behind an auto at 100 miles an hour. Don't know? Well, neither do 4 Point Pleasant residents who were chased by a weird man-like thing Tuesday night. 2 young Mason County married couples today told of being chased by the strange creature around midnight Tuesday. Mr. and Mrs. Steve Millett of 3505 Jackson Avenue and Mr. and Mrs. Roger Scayberry, 809 1/2 30th Street, described their hair-raising experiences, which began in the TNT area. The two couples were riding in a car, and as the auto crested a hill, an object loomed in front of them. The object was in the form of a man about 6 feet tall with wings on its back. Becoming frightened, the couples drove away. As they approached a traffic circle near Route 62, they said the thing loomed in front of the car again. Mallett, 20, said they drove toward Point Pleasant on Route 62 at 100 miles an hour, with the strange creature drifting along behind the car. The couple said the thing seemed to avoid lights. When they turned into the C.C. Lewis farm, the creature was again in front of the car. What appeared to be a large dead dog was lying on the road. Later, the couples and police returned to the farm, but the dog had vanished. Deputy Sheriff Millard Halstead searched the TNT area. The deputy said the thing was gone, but he found a strange pile of dust. Scarberry, 18, said, "Believe me, if you ever saw it, you'd be a believer." The men said they might go look for the thing tonight, but indicate they were afraid they might find it. The source for this was from themothman.fandom.com. Winged Red-Eyed Thing. One anonymous smart aleck compared this to his mother-in-law. Some thought the creature might have been a sandhill crane. Others a great horned owl. Others thought there might have been a connection to a UFO. High strangeness during this time wasn't limited to just the Mothman. Reports included mysterious men in black, later an inspiration for the Men in Black movies, spotted in a VW bug and dark sedans, a missing dog, UFO sightings, orbs of light, and even the enigmatic figure of Indrid Cold. There was the bizarre theory that Mothman might have been some alien's lost pet, and let's not forget the eerie appearance of a UFO interested in a Red Cross bloodmobile that seemed oddly out of place. It was a perfect storm of weirdness, a mashup of the surreal and the unexplained. Joseph Campbell said, "Myth is much more important and true than history. History is just journalism, and you know how reliable that is." Lepidoptera, about moths. Lepidoptera, better known as moths, used to gather near porch lights and doorways more often than they seem to do now. I hadn't noticed their absence until I really stopped to take a look. Smaller moths still flutter here and there, but the larger ones, the ones that seem to carry a mysterious weight with their silent wings, have become what seems to be more rare visitors, making me wonder where they went. These smallish six-legged insects, wings, a belly, an exoskeleton, yes, moths have one, and head topped with antenna. Lepidoptera. Okay, that's how it's supposed to be said. Lepidoptera. What was it like at your house as a kid? This won't sound very nice, but growing up, was your family a grab a Kleenex and squish the moth kind of household? Or get a cup to trap the moth in and escort them back outside through the creaking back door to freedom? The fainter than a whisper flutter of their wings echoing almost soundlessly into the darkness. Or back towards the porch light. One of my moth memories was the tiny white, thin-winged lawn moths dancing just above the grass in the summertime twilight. They would briefly get stirred up when I walked through the grass. The sky above the mountain peaks almost the color of Windsor Newton's Antwerp blue, bleu d'Anvers, the hue of a perfect summertime evening. The color seems to be before navy and not purple. This was the color when night began to draw its midnight cloak with pinpoints of stars gently whispering across the sky. And for a kid, it meant time to go inside. This is one of my earliest memories of moths. What's yours? A moth on the inside of a lampshade, maybe? Want to hear about an unusual coincidence with this story? Last summer, I was in my bedroom when I spotted a moth on the blackout blinds. Its wingspan was about the size of my palm. I hadn't seen a moth this size in a long time, if ever. I've seen sphinx moths. These are the size of hummingbirds. But this one, it was big, unlike the moths common to suburbia in Utah and national parks in Utah that I've seen. Mountains, red rocks, arches. Moths I've seen in passing. But this one went from UFO, it was landed and not flying. Unidentified Lepidoptera, my mystery moth, was what Glover.com, a local garden nursery, listed as, wow, here's a name, Aoliba underwing, Catocala aoliba. Quote, like most other underwing moths, the aoliba has dull gray and black speckled forewings, which help it blend into its surroundings, and bright orange underwings that it reveals to startle predators. While the larvae consume foliage of oak species, adults can be seen feeding on nectar, pollinating, sap, and rotting fruit. That's from GloverNursery.com, Butterflies Around the Wasatch Front by Reagan Glover Coon.
On the sunny side of life, it will help us every day, it will brighten all the way, if we keep on the sunny side of It will help us every day, it will brighten all the way, if we keep on the sunny side of life.
This sample is from the Carter family on the album In the Shadow of Clinch Mountain, and the song is Keep on the Sunny Side. The Carter family is known as an inspiration for country music in the United States. This is an example of bluegrass music. This sample came from the Internet Archive. It's not like I'm a lepidopterist or anything, but I figured... That just rolls off the tongue. Lepidopterist. But I figured I could take a very broad stab at finding the one out of 11,000 species of moth in North America as a casual bystander. Yeah, right. On an old, weathered, and gnarled tree trunk, under gathering night, the orange underwing, Archaearus parthenius, would be difficult to spot as a ghost on a ghost hunting show. I haven't seen a large moth like that, and wouldn't you know it, I happen to have the Falcon Pocket Guide to Butterflies and Moths, hard copy by Todd Tellander. And after quickly paging through the moth section and looking for my orange underwing moth, Archaearus parthenius, it was nowhere to be seen. With nearly 11,000 species of moths in North America, number via the Smithsonian Institution, the guide is not a comprehensive one. But there were some lovely examples. Todd illustrated the moths that were selected for the book. A really big moth showing up when it needed to, smack dab where I couldn't miss it. Eric did me the favor of catching the moth and taking it outside to release. Synchronicity? There was a synchronicity in the episode about Mummy Brown, if you want to go back to that episode. Who knows about these synchronicities that happen just at the right times? Kind of strange. I apologize for any mispronunciations of the moths and the scientific names for them. So, dark of night. Perhaps it's the changing light affecting suburban moths? Have you heard about the Dark Sky Initiative? I was late to the party, but my husband Eric swapped out our porch lights for ones that direct light downward, helping to reduce light pollution that's been spilling into the night to protect the balance of nature. Back in pre-LED times, that's light-emitting diode that came after the incandescent light bulb, retailers can no longer sell the banned light bulbs as of August 1st by Julia Jacobo. August 1st, 2023. Quote, in April 2022, the U.S. Department of Energy under the Biden administration announced the phase-out of energy-wasting light bulbs, banning the manufacture and sales of common incandescent light bulbs starting on August 1, 2023. And from Tell.com, a light-emitting semiconductor device, a light-emitting diode, LED, is a semiconductor device that emits light when a forward voltage is applied to it. That was from Tokyo Electron Limited, tell.com/museum/exhibition. It's debated whether LED does or doesn't attract bugs. Concerns envelope the decreasing number of insects, bees, and pollinators. People have figured out how to pollinate by hand, although it looks tedious, and I've read of people even pollinating by a bubble. What do we call a gathering of moths? A murder, like with crows? A conspiracy, like with ravens? It seems to be just moths, plural, with an S. Mothman emerged from the shadows with a much darker message, a silent sadness emanating from him, a warning that seemed almost otherworldly. Let's rewind to 1966, Point Pleasant, West Virginia. A creature, man-like but winged, with glowing red eyes, was spotted by multiple witnesses at different times. They called it Mothman, and it wasn't long before his presence was linked to a tragic event. In December of the following year, 1967, the Silver Bridge connecting West Virginia and Ohio collapsed, without warning, claiming 46 lives. Some say Mothman's sightings were portents, a harbinger of disaster. So, when you flick on your porch light tonight, or maybe it's automated, take a moment to glance upward. Is the dark sky empty, or is Mothman out there somewhere just beyond the glow of the town or city? The shadows might hold more than meets the eye. What could he be waiting for? An enthusiastically loved, empathic cryptid, or would that be emotion-sharing cryptid, sharing a feeling of great sadness, who was possibly unable to communicate a terrible warning before the catastrophic Silver Bridge collapsed? The Silver Bridge connected West Virginia and Ohio, spanning the Ohio River, and this happened just before Christmas 1967. The appearance of the Mothman was thought by some to be a warning prior to this tragedy. One theory. Portents. Do you believe that there are signs of what's to come? A portent is interpreting a sign as something that foreshadows a coming event or an omen, that a change is coming, supposed to be good or bad, but often foreshadows. Portents, as defined by the Oxford Classical Dictionary, are, quote, phenomena seen as in some way indicating the future, generally believed to be of divine origin, unquote. Were these Mothman sightings spontaneous warnings, or were they sought, pieced together, in hindsight as a desperate attempt to make sense of the senseless. Who used portents? Mesopotamians. Surprise! If you want to look up Ghost of the Clay Tablet episode. Anyone? Greeks. Arabs, Hebrew, Chinese. Human beings. Omen, portent, harbinger. Wikipedia.org/wiki/ornithomancy. Oxford Classical Dictionary shares, quote, portents may be defined as phenomena seen as in some way indicating the future, which are generally believed to be of divine origin. Such signs frequently occur spontaneously, although they may be sought. So how do portents come into Mothman's story? The version commonly taken as history, the story taken from John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, is about a string of incidents of high strangeness, sightings of the Mothman by many people in the community, and then unrelated weirdness, anecdotes of things witnessed that seem to have nothing to do with the cryptid, and then were folded into Mothman's legend. They considered all of this unpredictable strangeness, from the Mothman to the aliens, a portent to the terrible collapse of the Silver Bridge. They being used loosely, some people. At least one of the witnesses sensed sadness coming from Mothman. So it was theorized that he knew what was coming with the bridge collapse. An empath cryptid? Or would that make the witness an empath and the Mothman able to tell the future? Frank Frazetta, a legend in fantasy art, revolutionized science fiction and fantasy images with his dynamic book covers, comic art, and film posters. Think Conan the Barbarian or A Princess of Mars? Swords raised usually in an action pose. Among the iconic Mothman creations is the oil painting Mothman, inspired by John Keel's 1975 book, The Mothman Prophecies. Frazetta's Mothman is a striking fusion of menace and beauty. The Mothman, with vibrant butterfly-like wings, though butterfly is far from the creature's vibe as per the witnesses, he is a muscular and imposing figure. Shiny UFOs loom in the background. A young couple in the foreground is attempting to flee in terror, probably inspired by one of the original witnesses' account. His dramatic composition perfectly captures the fear invoked and mystery surrounding the legend. The Mothman painting first appeared on the cover of High Times magazine in 1980, and was later used for the cover of the 1991 reprint of Keel's book, making the colorful and riveting rendering an enduring part of the Mothman's folklore and surrounding art legacy. Born in Brooklyn, Frazetta studied at the Brooklyn Academy of Fine Arts before building his career illustrating comic strips, pulp covers, and his paintings were even used as metal album art. His masterful renderings, use of color, anatomy, and composition gave life to heroes like Tarzan, Conan, and of course, our Mothman. Frazetta's works balance fantasy and realism, as seen in his Dark Kingdom painting, where a lone, winged-helmeted, red-caped warrior charges directly toward the viewer, full of strength and purpose. Or his otherworldly creature, a winged alligator, exhaling a plume of fire into the night while rising from troubled waters. In Silver Warrior, a polar bear-drawn sledge cuts through the frozen tundra, bearing a fierce warrior into an icy unknown. And then there's Death Dealer, the horned helmeted figure astride a dark steed, one of his most celebrated, popular, and haunting works. It was actually hanging up on one of the whiteboards in one of the classes when I was going for my illustration degree. Whether depicting monstrous creatures or heroic figures, Frazetta's art draws viewers into otherworldly realms filled with danger, power, and mystery. The haunting painting, Mothman, lives in the Frazetta Museum in Pennsylvania, where it may be giving a few chills to this day. Joseph Campbell said, "We have not even to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. Okay, art lovers and creative friends, from Frazetta to local West Virginia artist, who has found even more acclaim posthumously due to the popularity of his statue of Mothman. It's on the must-see list of every visitor seeking out Mothman stories, selfies, pepperoni rolls, and souvenirs. Speaking of looking for things out there in the dark of night in West Virginia, this stainless steel art anomaly, statue, is in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and yeah, it's of a cryptid, creature they haven't proved to exist yet, memorializing what some want to believe was a sign, a warning of the tragedy to come of the Silver Bridge collapse. The 12-foot statue is of the creature sighted in Point Pleasant in 1966-67, an unknown creature now dubbed the Mothman. 12-foot tall, polished steel, created by retired welding supervisor and U.S. Navy veteran turned welding artist Robert Bob Roach. Unveiled in 2003, the imposing burnished steel cryptid is located at 201 4th Street, Point Pleasant, West Virginia. The statue has a human figure from a weightlifter for reference. Large red eyes, braided rows of hair, and large butterfly wings on his back. Another thing Joseph Campbell said as a mythology scholar really seemed to fit this episode. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. We have only to follow the thread of the hero path, and where we had thought to find an abomination, we shall find a god. And where we had thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves. Where we had thought to travel outwards, we shall come to the center of our own existence. And where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world. Wow. We shall be with all the world. The '60s. Peace, love, and Mothman. In 1966 and 67, Mothman was sighted in West Virginia, which is on the eastern side of the United States. It made the newspaper, but he wasn't the only game in town, or rather, North America. October 20th of 1967, the Patterson-Gimlin film, Horseback Footage, was taken at 18 frames per second in Northern California of a Sasquatch. Much debated to be a costume or real, and later dubbed Patty. The film was first shown to scientific organizations and later shared on TV shows like Merv Griffin's and Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. And it was covered in a Reader's Digest article, too. Just under a decade later, Patty was mentioned on In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy on Season 1, Episode Number 5, Bigfoot. In Search Of was later. I believe it was in the 1970s. Cryptids were on the brain. What was going on in 1967? Let's just say nobody was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize that year. Let's take a very short look, shall we? I finished making my notes from looking at the year, and what a train wreck. I reached for ChatGPT's help because there was so much going on. Here's the collaboration in a nutshell. A ton got cut that was interesting. I'm just trying to keep us on track. 1967 was chaos. Wars and unrest dominated by the Vietnam War, Six-Day War, the Space Race, and Cold War continued. Race riots and civil conflicts broke out in the U.S., Nigeria, and Cambodia. Natural disasters, bushfires, earthquakes, floods, and tornadoes struck. The first heart transplant and pulsar discovery marked scientific milestones, and culturally, Loving versus Virginia legalized interracial marriage. The UK decriminalized homosexuality, and the Beatles sang All You Need Is Love. Okay, world, good work on these. Amid the tragedies like the Silver Bridge collapse in Point Pleasant, where 46 people perished, maybe the stories like the Mothman, UFO, and Bigfoot sightings, Patterson-Gimlin film and Patty, were maybe a welcome distraction? It's been said that the Mothman was sighted near the Silver Bridge, called that due to the aluminum paint color. The official name was the Point Pleasant Bridge. The Silver Bridge collapsed at 4:58 on Friday, December 15th during rush hour, West Virginia, Eastern Time. the Silver Bridge connected Point Pleasant to Gallipolis, Ohio. This was the same night as the Christmas tree lighting at the White House. President Johnson delivered a Christmas greeting and lit the tree at roughly 5:56 p.m. There's a little more to that that I'll talk about in a minute. So engineering details from transportation.wv.gov/highways/bridgefacts. It's West Virginia, wv.gov. At 5 p.m. on December 15, 1967, eyewitnesses recall there was a loud gunshot-like noise, and folding like a deck of cards, in less than 20 seconds, the entire 1,460-foot suspended portion of the Silver Bridge collapsed into the river, taking with it 32 vehicles and 46 victims, including two whose bodies were never found. The safety board finally issued its determination of the cause of the collapse. A cleavage fracture in the lower limb of I-bar 330 at joint C13N of the north I-bar suspension chain in the Ohio side span. The fracture was caused by the development of a critical size flaw over the 40-year life of the structure as the result of the joint action of stress corrosion and corrosion fatigue. Unquote. The bridge collapse was the catalyst for positive change in bridge safety and how bridges are inspected and taken care of in the United States. An I-bar chain suspension bridge failure was due to a defect in a single link known as I-bar 330 on the north of the Ohio subsidiary chain. Think of a bicycle chain. The Silver Bridge was an I-bar suspension bridge built in 1928, which carried U.S. Route 35 over the Ohio River, constructed like a bicycle chain, but with no redundancy of chains, just one, which led to the tragedy. More from the WV.gov, quote, "The tragedy led to the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1968, which established a national bridge inspection program, which created bridge inspection standards still in use today," unquote. There are 46 inlaid bricks memorializing the people who were lost the night the bridge collapsed at a memorial in the city. People crossing the bridge were Christmas shoppers, commuters, trucks, and some employees from the Goodyear plant, some from the rail yard, when the bridge began to shake. There was a witness stopped at the red light and not on the bridge. The bridge always shook, but this was different. So here we are. Now about the Christmas tree lighting. It was happening at pretty much the same time they were trying to recover people from the river, and the river water was 32 degrees. So the White House Christmas trees. 373 miles down I-68 at the White House in Washington, D.C., close to an hour later, President Johnson gave a Christmas greeting, and the national Christmas tree was lit. The official name of the tree outside the White House. National Christmas tree, it's a thing. A Vermont-sourced 70-foot balsam fir. The National Park Foundation and National Park Service are involved in the actual lighting of the tree. It's outside on display for the public, on the ellipse south of the White House. It's still a thing they do today. Tradition holds that the blue room in the White House is where the official Christmas tree, donated from the National Christmas Tree Association, NCTA, is located. So forgive this quick trip down a rabbit hole, but do you remember Melania's red Christmas trees from 2018 in the east colonnade of the east wing of the White House? The plain monochromatic hue of red seemed a bit unusual. But New Yorkers, where Melania previously lived, like art and color, like the saffron gates by Christo and Jean-Claude. Millions visited the gates, public artwork in Central Park, covering 23 miles for 16 days in 2005. There were 45 red trees that weren't spray-painted or flocked red, but designed by the First Lady and created by three florist volunteers, from styrofoam cones by attaching fake cranberries, creating a consistent cranberry red hue. I don't remember anyone mentioning that the First Lady had designed the trees using a theme. Her office called it American Treasures. It was shown as red cylinder trees on TV. A little bit of further editing would have shown berries close up, or spanning across a section. They just looked weird from afar. I wonder what happened to them. 46 trees of styrofoam? Are they in a landfill somewhere? Via the Cut, Searching for Melania Trump's Red Christmas Trees by Rhonda Gerlich, quote, her office claimed that the monochromatic trees were actually a nod to the red pails or stripes on the presidential seal, and that the color stood for bravery and valor, an answer meeting the usual White House quotient of truthiness. From thecut.com. Some were reminded of The Handmaid's Tale. I'm sure it was not the intended vibe of this collection of trees. As recovery and aftermath of the bridge collapse carried on, the president's Christmas remarks were broadcast nationally, televised on the nightly news. The White House Christmas tree art, which was on their Christmas cards, shows a fluffy tree with lights and tinsel and red and light blue baubles. WhiteHouseChristmasCards.com, Lyndon Johnson 1963 through 69. Quote, for the official White House Christmas cards and gift prints of 1967, Mrs. Johnson decided to end the presidential plantings series and instead requested that Lazig paint the official White House Christmas tree on display in the Blue Room. President Johnson and the First Lady ordered 2,600 presidential Christmas cards and 3,000 gift prints, all featuring Lazig's Blue Room Christmas tree painting, unquote. 1967, the Blue Room Christmas tree was blue spruce from Ohio, same as 65 and 66, but with silver baubles, silver stars, and round mirrors added. In conclusion, West Virginia, home of the initial Mothman sightings, and a whole lot of weird stuff reported starting in 1966 through 67, when the Silver Bridge collapsed, a cool fantasy painting by Frank Frazetta, an iconic statue by Bob Roach of the Mothman. Joseph Campbell said, it is the function of art to carry us beyond speech to experience. There was a whole lot of high strangeness surrounding the time period of the Mothman sightings, a lot of creative explanations like him being the lost pet of aliens, or an empath cryptid type creature. The possibility that his appearance as a portent to the collapse of the Silver Bridge remains a mystery. Has he been spotted again, as reported at other disasters like tsunamis or 9/11, Chernobyl? Is it possible, in part, the story could be true? Or did they see something else easily explained away like an owl or sandhill crane? The art stands as a reminder of the sightings and strangeness experienced, and perhaps we shouldn't dismiss all of those reports like we know better. Maybe we should give the witnesses a little bit of credit for being able to tell us what they saw. From Creative Mythology, The Masks of God, number 4, Campbell said, life is like arriving late for a movie, having to figure out what was going on without bothering everybody with a lot of questions, and then being unexpectedly called away before you find out how it ends. Want to hear more about Mothman? The Astonishing Legends podcast unfurled a multi-part series about Mothman, and they do a great job diving into the details. You can also look for the book The Silver Bridge by Gray Barker. Thank you for joining me for this strange story tonight. I hope you will subscribe so you catch future episodes of The Whispering Gallery. Please consider leaving a review. It is one of the ways I get feedback, and I have heard it really helps the podcast to be found by others. The Whispering Gallery podcast is written and produced by me, Suzanne Nicolaisen. Copyright Suzanne Nicolaisen, 2025. All media was used under the protection of fair use. You can support the podcast by volunteering or donating. Links are at thewhisperinggallerypodcast.com. The score for the podcast is Spellcraft, provided by Jeff Harvey on Pixabay. Other audio music and sound effects were provided by audio engineers and musicians on Freesound. I will be working on the research for the next spine-tingling episode of The Whispering Gallery about the strange, unexplainable, and spooky side of art. Remember to keep your flashlight close and your spooky art stories closer when visiting The Whispering Gallery. Take care.